welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews, and I am an assistant editor at Firehouse.com. Thank you for joining us today for part two of Going for the Grants, How to Win the Money, Grant Money, with Brian Vickers. In the first part of this four-part series, we covered some of the basics about what your department should be looking for and how they should go about getting grant money from the Assistance to Firefighter Grant Program and other programs that are available for us in the fire service out there. Today we will continue to go over some things that really will help you and your department to grab the money, go ahead of everybody else. With that, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Plumavent. Plumavent's diesel exhaust removal system features 100% source capture to eliminate all diesel exhaust from the firehouse, as stated in the NFPA 1500 standard. Plumavent diesel exhaust removal systems meet the requirements stated in the Fire Act Grant Program guidance for modifications to facilities. Please visit plumavent.com, that's PlyMovent.com, or click on the link on this page to learn more about their exhaust removal systems. Thank you to Plumavent. Today's presentation at RadioFires.com is brought to you by Brian Vickers. Brian Vickers has been a member of the fire service for more than 12 years and is currently an engineer and EMT with the Community Volunteer Fire Department in Houston, Texas, where he previously served in the roles of District Chief and Department Training Officer. Brian Holt has a bachelor's degree in computer information systems management and is also pursuing a master's of business administration with a concentration in e-business. Brian is employed as a full-time senior programmer and analyst for Land Data Systems Incorporated of Houston. Brian is also a freelance grant writer and fire service consultant. In the last 4 years, Brian has brought in over $11 million in grants for the departments he has worked with. His grant information is also available on his website. It's firegraphics.org. That's www.firegraphics.org. Okay, we'll get this rolling. Brian, thank you for joining us today. To get this started, what can we change with an application to get the project that a department is going for a more competitive level to branch out and go above everybody else?
Well, there's not too many things you can do with your statistics and things like that. Whether we're looking at call volume and population, things we really don't have any control of. The only things we do really have control of would be the project itself, which is what we're asking for to solve whatever problem we happen to have. And, of course, our narrative, which is how we explain what our problem is, what our plan for the solution is, and how much it's going to cost. A lot of departments in the project design are just simply asking for the wrong thing. They're going for something that may not entirely fix their problem. They're asking for an incomplete solution. Or they're just asking for too many things at once. DHS calls it a laundry list, which is just listing off, you know, if we had all these 50 items, you know, it would fix all of our problems and we'd be the perfect fire department. And when it happens, you end up throwing a lot of low-priority items in there. The grant programs are made to aim for basically the big rocks, the big problems that we have, we as the fire service face. Replacement of gear, replacement of air packs, and, of course, replacement of vehicles. I mean, a lot of high-dollar items that we use on a daily basis and, of course, get a lot of wear and tear and have to be replaced after certain periods of time. They're not looking really, they will, but they're not looking really to fund, you know, things like computers or CD training for the firefighters. It's any training they want to see hands-on. If anybody can really sit in front of a computer, at that point it's almost like a video game. So other than that, once we start going to, you know, listing long things, you end up with a lot of things that are relatively inexpensive. We need to go for a cascade system that costs $40,000. Most departments will need to match anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000 for that project, or up to $8,000 in an urban setting. So essentially we're saying at that point we've got $2,000 to $8,000 in cash sitting around, and when you start to add in there, well, maybe we need a gas meter or we need some extra hose and things like that, not only do we change the focus of the project away from the fact that, you know, we have no way to fill our air bottles over to we need a whole bunch of little items that are completely unrelated. Gas meters on average cost $1,500, so they're going to look at that and say, well, you know, we're saying, you know, we need this cascade, we've got $2,000, but we can't use that $2,000 to buy this $1,500 gas meter. So it's the perception on the other end of what we're really asking for. And just they may have a lot of merits just for that cascade system, but by adding a couple other things, we've lost focus at that point and taken our eye off the big prize, which is we really need, you know, a way to fill our air bottles.
Okay. All right. So I guess if you're, say, going to place a new engine in service to replace a pretty old engine, and you're coming about the time, you know, you need a thermal imaging camera and a CO meter, and, you know, some of the old hose is on its way out and hasn't passed inspections and stuff like that, really just go for the big budget items. Don't go for the small things, a nozzle or a couple lengths of hose. Just, you're saying pretty much just hit the big money, big ticket items.
Not entirely along that. It depends on what you identify as your greatest need is. Go back to the compressor example. We identified our biggest need was we need a way to fill our air bottles, and that should stay the focus. If we happen to get a new engine and we have no equipment to put on it, so essentially it can't do its job, well, we need to ask for the things that make that, you know, pumper a pumper. We need the hose. We need the nozzles. Thermal imager is certainly helpful. They all go together because the problem is we can't get that truck in service. It's not that we don't have these all little items, but, you know, at that point, you know, ask for the thermal imager, you know, if we need the air packs to go on that truck, or, you know, the large diameter hose or some nozzles. They are expensive items, but they all are related to getting that truck in service and basic firefighting. Now, I wouldn't go so far to say we need to add all the flashlights on the truck or, you know, things like that, but certainly, I mean, if we need handheld radios at that point, they're expensive items in most areas, just because of the frequency you're on. But we don't want to go too far and say, you know, we bought this new truck, but we didn't think we really needed any of the other stuff to go with it. That may be the perception theirs if we're asking for too much to put that truck in service.
Okay.
So in a lot of cases, they say, yes, you know, let's just look at the bigger things that we really, really can't afford and go for that route.
Okay. Are you aware of any departments who have in the past put in for the, like you said, laundry list, and they've actually received it? I mean, is that something that may happen from time to time? Or
it may happen. It's happened several times, actually, but it's not often.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, they're the lucky ones versus the rule. I mean, the idea is we want to create a tight application to solve a focused problem. But certainly there's people out there that have, you know, explained away why they need simply everything. And in some certain circumstances with budgets and things, certainly they do. But it's more that they got lucky and got those things through. So they may be the one in 1,000, you know, the exception that makes the rule. You know, rather than, you know, take the lucky chance that we're going to be that one in 1,000, the idea is to design the application so that we're in with, you know, the one in 3 chance of getting that equipment.
Okay. When, I guess if you're replacing old stuff or worn out stuff, stuff that's heavily used, you know, that's understandable. What about upgrades and stuff like that? Like in my new department here, they've upgraded the SCBAs, and every department had to come online and comply with it, which means the purchase of new SCBAs and face pieces for each member and stuff like that. Is that something you could do? Is an upgrade something that fits that line, or is that just something that may go in the necessary or may not be necessary?
It depends on the project. Certainly, you know, the focus is on stuff that is very old, very worn, and very unsafe. Certainly, straight up, someone has a better chance of trying to replace 15-year-old air packs than 6 or 7-year-old air packs. Even though both sets really don't meet NFPA compliance, it's not, in the grand scheme of things, it's more cost-effective of a priority to replace the 15-year-old set. Because they're obviously near the end of their service life, and they are certainly more older and worn than the 6 or 7-year-old packs. In that case, certainly you can apply for an upgrade to the air pack. Most manufacturers can replace a lot of the components to make them. The latest is NFPA 1981-2002 edition with the Root Connections and Buddy Breather heads-up display and integrated pass. For the department that has the, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old air packs, they're really only halfway through their usable life. And they're probably upgradable at that point. Most upgrades are somewhere around $1,000, $1,200. Versus a new air pack, it may be $3,000 to $4,000. So within that same project, the idea is to meet the goal. The goal is NFPA compliant air packs. For that 6 to 7 year old air pack department, they can upgrade 4 air packs for the price of a new one. So we've solved the problem, which is getting new air, you know, compliant air packs, but it costs a whole lot less. And so they're going to score a lot higher on the cost benefit scoring when they go through with it and see that we can do, you know, we can get the same result with a whole lot less money. If it's entirely possible, with some manufacturers it's not. It's something that should be looked into. And that's where we get into the discussion a lot of times when, you know, I don't want that, I want this. And this, you know, with grant programs, it's not really about what you want, it's about what you need. And if the need is to solve your problem, and a solution solves it for a lot less money, well, of course, if it was our money coming out of our pocket, well, yeah, I want to spend a whole lot less to get the same thing. But it seems reversed when we look at the grant program and say, well, when it's not my money, I want the best and latest and the greatest.
All right. With that, do you have to go through like a bidding process where you can just pick any manufacturer's product as long as they, I guess, fall under the NFPA and OSHA and whatever your local compliance needs would be? I mean, you don't have to go out and say, you know, we can get this apparatus for this price and this apparatus for this price and this apparatus for this price? Or?
DHS does require a minimum of 2 bids to be requested with federal funds. Unless your local area, some states or townships, municipalities have a 3-bid minimum that you must get. And of course, it's request bids. In certain areas, there are only one, you know, there is only one vendor for certain products, so it's kind of hard to get a bid in that case when there is only one person you can buy it from anyway. But certainly, it's in the department's best interest to competitively bid as much as possible and get more for the money. If you do decide in a lot of areas, there are co-op purchasing programs, whether it's state bid. Some areas, we have it here in Houston, Houston-Galveston Area Council is a purchasing co-op. At that point, we can just go on and pick what we want, and everything is pre-bid, so we can just compare prices. That's allowable under the grant programs. That makes it a little shorter. But certainly, if, you know, someone doesn't have a specific brand in mind, even if you do, you still got to go out and competitively bid it. In certain cases, like air packs and things, where we're talking interoperability with neighbors, of course, part of the bid is that you want to be compatible with your neighbors, because part of your grant was that you needed to be interoperable with your neighbors when you're upgrading your equipment. So in some cases, you know, you do have to get the bids, but you certainly can have performance metrics put in your bids. That does depend on your local jurisdiction and regulations.
Okay. Now, when you said interoperable, is that everything from radios to hoses to SCBAs to, stuff that's going to be in the firehouse? Or is it just under certain parameters, or is it for the whole picture?
It's for the whole picture. And certainly interoperable communications, it helps for everybody to be on the same radio system. Everybody can talk to each other. I mean, we're certainly at some point in our careers are going to have some kind of mass-scale incident, and even on a regular basis, we deal with automatic and regular mutual aid departments, and you want to be able to work as smoothly as possible to get the job done. Communications-wise, certainly need to be interoperable in communications, but it does go all the way down to air packs. A lot of places where personnel is short, you've got mutual aid departments coming in to be rapid intervention teams. If their CBA is not compatible with the department that's, you know, in their own district, they're going to have a hard time making a proper rescue because the equipment's incompatible. In some areas, you have one department uses all 5-inch with Storch connections. Another area uses threaded 4-inch. Anything, you know, any operational problem you have when you're working with a department other than your own can be a cause for, you know, increased interoperability in your project. Whatever sort of items will help create that. Vehicles really doesn't apply there because only one department is going to be using the vehicle. But of course, you want to look at what other equipment your mutual aid has and see what else you need to add to that and pick hose sizes and things to make everything work together.
Okay. Then going back to the SCBA, I guess something else is, say if you're looking for a compressor to refill the cascade system, is that something you can get for a truck, or is it better to get a trailer-mounted unit? Or what about, you know, an in-house where, you know, a couple departments can come by and use yours as long as you're using the same system?
It depends on your need and how you think you're going to use the unit. If you've got, you know, some areas don't have the room to park a trailer in their station. They just don't have it there because of the way the building's created. But they have a station compressor in there already. It does still have to suit your local needs. Certainly, a trailer-mounted compressor and cascade system can be towed by about any vehicle on the market that has a tow hitch. So you can take it anywhere. With a minimum amount of manpower, you can take one person in a utility vehicle or even a personal vehicle and take it to a scene and refill air bottles halfway across the county or across the county. And pretty much as long as you've got fuel in the tank, you've got an unlimited air supply, and that's certainly needed on hazardous materials incidents, technical rescues such as confined space and trench, but it has to meet the need as well. If you've got no vehicles that could tow something like that, you don't have a vehicle that you could put a cascade system on, it could work. But it is really up to how it's going to meet your needs specifically. If a trailer's not going to work, then, certainly putting on a vehicle or having in the station would solve your problem. As long as you define it and say, this is the way, we work, this is going to fit our needs a whole lot better. Once it starts getting into the reasoning, I want this, I want it, for this reason, and that's where some applications start to falter, is that they're looking at something they want, not necessarily something they need.
Okay. With apparatus, do they have a prioritized list, say like a priority one type of vehicle versus priority two versus priority three? Is there a list in that matter?
Yeah, in the program guidance, there's different types of vehicles for different classifications between the rural, the suburban, and the urban department, of course. And they go by definition. Rural, of course, stereotypical rural department has very few hydrants, so we find tankers, usually have open fields, so we'll find brush trucks, and of course every classification has pumpers as a priority one truck as well. In an urban setting, of course, you expect to have a municipal water supply, and tanker is really not a priority. And within urban, that is the only classification that has a priority, has rescue as a priority one truck. There's certainly other vehicles down in priority two, command vehicles, hazardous materials, vehicles, air and light units, and of course in the suburban and rural areas, standalone rescue trucks. It's really not just because of the competition. It's really not a good idea to go after a priority two truck. There have been a handful awarded, but again, they are the minority, two or three or even five out of the almost 1,000 awards in 2005. It's really not good odds, especially when you consider there's been over 7,000 vehicle applications a year since 2003. So it's basically a 1 in 10 shot to get a truck and almost a 1 in 1,000 to get a priority two truck. So if there's other ways to solve the problem you're thinking, if you're rural or suburban and think you need a rescue-type apparatus, then certainly we just need rescue capabilities, whether it's pre-connected hydraulic tools or a cascade system or just something to carry everything we need for the rescue. Those can be incorporated into other trucks, whether they're quints or even making a rescue pumper out of it, or if you really just need a set of jaws or things like that in a rural area, we can incorporate those features into a brush or quick attack truck. So, again, it's not the ideal. Maybe, we did only want a standalone rescue truck, but that's not the priority of the program. We have to tailor what we're going to do. And, of course, incorporating those rescue features into a priority one truck, it solves our problem. We now have a way to get our rescue equipment and our personnel to the scene to mitigate the incident. I said it's within project design, there's things we want, and then there's things that, solve the problem, which, if we think about it, that, we need to solve the problem. That's the place that some people don't start at. They start at, thinking they want a certain piece of equipment versus solving the problem. And if you keep solving the problem is the main focus of your application and how you're going about putting it together, those are the applications that succeed year after year.
Okay, so it's not a bad idea to get a pumper tanker or a rescue engine or rescue pumper, because you can put everything in one spot. And I mean, would that make something more on the priority one level? Is that possible to create an apparatus for a level one situation where you can buy, like the Quint, for instance, you're getting everything on one piece of apparatus?
Yeah, that's usually how you could do it. I mean, you have to pick something that fits their definition of priority one. They did get rid of, they have them in the classification, but really the only ones are, you know, underneath the pumper, they count a rescue pumper as a pumper because that's its main job. Under pumper tanker, it's the same thing. It's primarily a tanker. But even with brush and quick attack trucks, you have to pick the priority one truck and then, of course, adjust it and design it to fit your needs to be able to handle those extra duties of rescue. That doesn't mean that it's going to be a solve-all problem. You still need to be, you know, having looked at your situation and see whether or not you're even competitive for a truck in the first place. If you've got a newer fleet, then even if you design it as a priority one truck, just with those rescue features, you have other vehicles that you could have done that with before that. So they are going to look to award people that have older vehicles before you, as well as people that don't have a lot of vehicles within the certain categories that they think they need.
Okay, and this is probably in the application program. Do the rigs have to be spec'd out, or is this something you can kind of get an idea about what it's going to be price-wise, and then you design it if you do get the grant?
You certainly want to spend a little time getting informal bids. People I work with say, you know, what kind of pump size or aerial length or tank size or certain features, whether we want foam, class A and B foam or compressed air foam, how many people do we want to carry on the truck, you know, what kind of chassis style we're looking at, and get a ballpark figure, you know, because you don't want to, I mean, the worst thing you can do is just throw out a random number for what you say you need and then get the award and find your, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 short because we didn't even pick up the phone call to check with anybody to see what it is. It's worth those extra few minutes just to check and shop around and find something you think that would meet your needs. It's maybe been you know, checking new delivery sites for the vehicle manufacturers and finding a truck that you think would suit your needs and calling them up and say, how much was that truck? You know, how much would it be today? Or even predicting how much is it going to be in 6 months. Luckily this year, Department of Homeland Security, which they do every year, they reassess pricing for certain classes of equipment. Steel prices went up a whole lot in the past year. So what they used to have as an award max ceiling for certain trucks went up approximately $20,000 per truck just because steel prices went up. There's no way we could buy, you know, the same truck that was built last year is going to cost anywhere from $10,000, $15,000 to even $30,000 or $40,000 more when you get up to aerials, just because it's a larger vehicle and there's more steel involved.
All right, Brian, well, thank you very much.
This presentation is proudly sponsored by Plimovent. Plimovent is a driving force in advancing firefighter health and safety. Plimovent's diesel exhaust removal systems feature 100% source capture to eliminate all diesel exhaust from the firehouse, as stated in NFPA 1500. Plimovent diesel exhaust removal systems meet the requirements stated in the Fire Act Grant Program guidance for modifications to facilities. Visit plimovent.com or click on the link on this page to learn more about their exhaust removal systems.
Okay, Brian, let's get back into this, and this is, I guess we can hit the meat and potatoes of the actual, the application itself, the physical process of doing it. There's the headings that they hit on, the operational benefits, the project cost benefits, the local funding, and the project description. I guess it's best to stay in those parameters of what they set out for you. Don't really veer off course too much, or...
Yeah, it's each, the top of the narrative, which is where we're basically explaining our side of the story beyond what the numbers say in the statistical portion. They want to hear, you know, hear what your project description is, you know, what are you planning on doing, including, you know, what is your problem, how are you going to solve it, They want to know about your financial need, what kind of money you have, and where is it going. Of course, they want to hear about the cost-benefit of the project. I mean, why is this the most cost-effective way that you're solving a problem? And the operational outcomes at the end is, you know, how is this going to enhance your day-to-day operations? I mean, how is this problem, how is the solution you've came up with for this problem is the best one for enhancing life and safety in your area? And a lot of people, they put those descriptions in the program guidance, and of course it's right at the top of the application on the narrative headings. Those are the headings they look for. Unbeknownst to most people is that that's exactly the same way the score sheet is lined up in peer review. So even though you may have all those elements in your narrative, they don't really only have, and the peer reviewers only have about 6 to 10 minutes to read each application. So if you just have a series of paragraphs, and if they're not in order, or you argue different points in different paragraphs out of order, and they may have seen something and say, well, where's their funding issues? I thought I read something. If they can't find it in a timely manner, well, then they're pretty much going to mark it at a low score because you obviously weren't very clear in explaining your problem and your funding issues. Using the headings on the page keeps you in line because then you realize, what is supposed to go in each section. And this year in the DHS PowerPoint from the workshop, they've detailed, somewhere in the middle, I believe it's slides 59 through 66, they've actually detailed the bullet points that they're looking for within each section. Underneath project description, they want to see what kind of goals you're meeting and what your standards and regulations will be that you meet, such as NFPA and OSHA. Under financial need, they want to know how much money you get every year and what you're spending it on. It's not a problem to have a very large budget. They just want to know, are you spending it? I mean, do you have a large salary and benefit for your paid employees or, truck payments and things like that? Or is it just all going, into the bank and saving it up for a rainy day for whatever reason? And, of course, cost-benefit, they want to know how much is this stuff going to be used. I mean, if you're asking for rescue equipment, I mean, how many rescue calls do you actually have? Is it one or two maybe a year? Or, you run on a daily basis to a couple car wrecks because you cover, Interstate 95. They want to know, why is this a problem in your area? And why is this solution the best one? Then you want to know about, is this going to make you interoperable? I mean, are these going to be tools that everybody in the district can have? Are you the technical rescue department for your entire county? Of course, you want to know what happens if you don't get the award. Certainly most of us are going to keep doing what we're doing with what we've got. But they want to know, are we going to change our tactics because our gear isn't safe anymore? Are we going to have to do more defensive operations? Are we going to have to call more mutual aid to handle this problem? Using the headings helps just stay on that line to make sure we include everything they're looking for. Because the more you leave out, obviously the lower your score gets because they can't mark it off on that score sheet.
Okay, so they're really, they're a couple minutes they're looking at it, so they're definitely looking. I mean, for the key points, is there keywords you throw out there, only department or, countywide, district-wide, something like that? I mean, can you throw keywords in there that kind of say, listen, we're doing this particular, or we put in this particular grant because we're the only ones that provide this service to an area?
Certainly, if you're the only ones, they do score. It's better to be in that position than trying to start something new. If you've already established yourself on your own, you started training for a specific discipline, whether it's hazmat or, as I said, technical rescue, you trained a couple people, you've gotten a few pieces of equipment, but you just can't get a whole lot more, and you're getting busier because you are the only ones in the area, then certainly you've got a stronger application than someone that's not doing any of that stuff right now, doesn't have any training, and doesn't have the equipment either. Because the main purpose of this grant program, of course, if we go back to the front page of the program guide, it says it's here to enhance and support the fire service. Well, it's kind of hard to enhance and support your operations if you're not doing anything on your own already. It's kind of the same with funding issues. you know, especially in the volunteer system. You know, are you doing any fundraising? I mean, are you too busy to do fundraising? There's certainly nothing wrong with having too many calls to fundraise. You know, are you trying to become tax-based or increase the tax rate or reduce spending? You know, maybe buying, you know, a commercial chassis instead of a custom to save some money and save on a payment. You know, they don't, you know, it's not a problem to not be doing certain things, but you also don't want to hide what you are doing, because then it's kind of hard to get around the issue of, you know, why can we really not afford this? Well, we don't want to tell them about, you know, we upgrade our gear every 5 years. Well, there's nothing wrong with upgrading your PPE every 5 years. And if that's the reason you can't afford, you know, new air packs or that new truck, well, then that's a good thing, because, you know, certainly when you look at cost-benefit, you're making a great cost-benefit decision on your own, because PPE goes on every single call. You know, whether it's EMS or rescue or fire, we're always wearing our gear. So you made the decision to make sure your people are safe as they can be, and that's why we can't afford this fire truck. Or, you know, we can't afford new, you know, our gear happened to get 10 years old on us because we replaced our 20-year-old air packs and blew all the savings we had. And the area didn't grow, or, you know, the only factory in town closed down, and our tax base went away. Or even with people that managed to upgrade their apparatus on their own. I mean, when you manage to upgrade a 30-year-old truck by yourself, certainly you've got a major payment. And that may be taking most of your budget. Well, there's nothing wrong with fixing your own problems. That's actually more what they want to see, is that, you know, the grant is not a definite. I mean, only 1 in 4 applications are about to get awarded. And as I said, the money keeps going down. It may go away completely. We just don't know. And grants are not something to be dependent on year after year for your budget. So they certainly give points if you manage to solve a major operational problem on your own. Because at that point, you've got something to enhance or support. You understand that this is not going to fix, you know, the grant isn't going to fix every problem you have, but it'll give you a major boost and give you a heads up. And those are the type of explanations and applications that are succeeding, because people are being very forthright in what they're doing.
Okay. So you get this, you have some firefighters in the firehouse put stuff together, and it's pretty much written out, ready to go. You want to get approved, I'm sure, have some people look it over, double check it, spell check it, you know, make sure people aren't going off track and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, you definitely want to proofread it. I mean, every single one of us misspells a word on more than one occasion. And the easiest is to use a word processing program to help keep things organized. And certainly my handwriting is not the best, so most everything I do is typewritten so that I can even read it when I'm done with it. But certainly you want to use the word processor, spell check. You know, I always say to enlist, you know, enlist some other people out in the community if you can. You know, high school teachers, I mean, they're used to reading essays all day and, you know, having issues with arguments or saying, you know, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't necessarily have to be somebody familiar with the fire service to proofread this. Just anybody that's used to seeing, you know, business-type documents and understanding a flow and evaluating a cost-benefit, you know, they're used to seeing such things. And they can, you know, if you can make someone that's unfamiliar with the fire service understand why what you're trying to do is such a big problem and why the solution is the best, well then, you know, you've reached a major hurdle, because they don't even know what we're talking about, but they understand that, you know, this is big. We need to get this done. We need to get this fixed. You know, plus it's good to have somebody outside the department, because within the department everybody's got the kind of the same thought process about how our operations are going to work and how we'd use this thing. And, you know, somebody outside the department can look in from the outside and say, well, you know, why do you really do that? Is that really the best way to do something? So it may help you evaluate your tactics as well and say, well, maybe I do need to change this, or, you know, maybe this would be the better way to do that, or this would be the better solution to our problem than what we're applying for.
Okay. What about getting help from another department? Say, you know, you're in Smithtown, or you want to work with the people over in Smithville, just to kind of, you know, double check, make sure there's something that they've done. I mean, is it good to go to an outside source, somebody else who can write it? You know, for instance, yourself. that understands the process better, work with people who had applications put in the past and have won. I mean, that's definitely a better idea, I'd say, than just kind of winging it 3 days before and trying to get it through.
Well, certainly not. You got to spend a little time, you know, looking around and seeing what the resources are. I mean, I've been doing this for 5 years, but I mean, personally, I spend, you know, anywhere from 800 to 1,500 hours a year looking at applications and looking at different grant programs and making sure I understand it, because people do, you know, come to me for answers, and, you know, certainly I've got to keep ahead of my game because everybody else is keeping ahead of their game, so it just makes the process a little bit better. But borrowing stuff from other departments is kind of dangerous because, again, going back to the laundry list, you know, maybe they got one awarded last year. Well, again, that's a negative reinforcement, so we're not necessarily going to be able to do what they did. You know, they may be minor, but, you know, our square mileage is different, call volume, population, things like that. So it's not necessarily, you know, what worked last year is not necessarily going to work this year. So we need to make sure that, you know, we've done our assessment. And an assessment is kind of things that baffles a lot of people about this, is that, you know, what really is an assessment? Well, we need to look at, you know, who we are, where we're at, and what we're doing, and how can we do that more safely to benefit the citizens. You know, and we start with the high-level problems and look at the process, and then work our way down. We list off solutions and say, okay, you know, this is one way to fix that problem. Here's another way. What's the cost difference? You know, and which one works out better? So certainly after we come to that point, we can go out and go to the other department and say, hey, you know, we've looked at it. This was our problem. This is how we think we could solve it. You know, what do you think? You know, you guys kind of had the same problem last year or, you know, 2 years ago when you got your grant. You know, what was your process and how you arrived at that solution? That's a better way to go about it than just say, hey, can I borrow your grant narrative from last year and, you know, take a look at it, and or just copy and paste it and change the names. You know, you still have to start at the beginning and make sure that your process fits, and work from there. And you may come back to the same, you know, solution they did, but at least you did it for the right reasons, because it makes sense for your department, not just because someone else was successful.
Okay. So you were the committee that you're working with, everything's been going through, everything looks okay, you're pretty much ready to go. You need that DUNS number. How do you go about getting that?
DUNS number is Dun & Bradstreet, stands for Data Universal Numbering System. It's kind of like a Social Security number for businesses. It helps DHS uniquely identify each department to make sure that, you know, more than one, you know, my application isn't coming in for the same department, or that, you know, the people applying are actually who they say they are. And that's something that's required since last year. We're required to have a DUNS number on there in addition to the employer identification number. And that's required. Anymore, they really won't let the application go through without it. And the easiest way to get a hold of one, they do have a website, but of course, sometimes they say it takes 2 or 3 weeks for that to come back. And since we're almost 3 weeks away from the close of the application period, it's easier to call them at 866-705-5711. And of course, there are links off the application itself underneath the help, and at DHS's website at firegrantsupport.com. You can find their addresses and of course other contact numbers that you'll need to make sure you have everything. But they'll be able to give you one over the phone, and of course that's a lot quicker and easier, and that way you can punch it in and make sure that everything's done, and you can submit.
Okay. And what about NFIRS, the National Fire Incident Reporting System? Do you have to, you know, let them know ahead of time that you're going through this process, or is it only upon receiving word that you've won?
It's not a requirement beforehand. They like to know if you have won already, because it does cut down on the questions if you are coming up for award. It doesn't affect whether or not you would be getting an award. Certainly, of course, if, like some of the other reporting requirements that they have for receiving federal monies, they'd like you to report to NFIRS. I mean, as I said, NFIRS and USFA's research, of course, help build this program and realize where the problems are and what they are. So reporting to NFIRS helps, you know, in the grand scheme of things, long-term fire service strategies and what, you know, what we need and things like that. So you don't need to beforehand, but certainly it's you're going to have to afterwards, and it's a little extra paperwork, but it's certainly certainly worth it, you know, in exchange for receiving the award. Because of course, if you tell them no, then they're probably not going to give you the money anymore. They may give you a chance to say, "Are you sure about that?" But you know, you're definitely going to have to if you want to see that big check.
Okay. And then, what about in a situation with money-wise? You know, say you're trying to raise funds because you only have a little bit amount of money left in your bank account. Do you need anything from, say, you know, like a local bank or something like that, saying that you don't have the money to pay XYZ?
You don't need whatever matching money it calculates that you need to. You need to come up with an order for the award. You don't have to have at the time of award, but certainly when it comes down to the second level review, they're going to look and see, well, you know, we just explained away 99.5% of our budget for this year. That makes it look like we've got, you know, an extra $100 in the bank now. How are we really going to match that? In that case, it's good to have a letter of support. Some of the departments I work with, it does appear to be that way. They have such small budgets, and you know, they could probably fundraise aggressively or, you know, anything like that, but it's good just to have as a backing, have a letter of support sent to the main fire program's office from the bank that says, you know, we understand they're going for this grant, you know, we support the project. If for some reason, you know, they don't happen to have the money or they can't come up with it, you know, we as a bank will arrange financing so that they can.
Okay.
And give them the money. And that way, you know, you don't lose the award just based on appearance of not having any money. It's an additional, you know, letter support that can go in there and help your cause. And, you know, they may have the perception that you may not be able to afford it. And, of course, a letter like that will certainly convince them otherwise.
Okay. Is there anything else you really need to get done before you send the application out? You know, it's April 3rd, and I think everything's ready to go. Now what?
Well, we'll just double-check it. Certainly the application keeps a tally on the website on how complete your application is. Even though we proofread it before we ever punched anything in, we want to go in and double-check. Because complete just means that there's data where the application expects it to be. But we want to make sure it's the right data. Some department, you know, typos and things like that can give us false pretenses. One department by accident typed in, you know, they had 200 tall buildings, and, you know, they were going for an aerial, and of course, they really didn't have that, so when it came down to the tech review and it looked and said, well, no, we meant to type 20, they wouldn't have actually made peer review at that point. And it didn't really, you know, it just gave them a false sense of hope when they started to get some of the pre-notification stuff, but little things like that, you know, and misconceptions. A lot of the, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, you're putting in a complete solution. When you're going for gear, the question is, you know, how much of your active firefighting force will this protect? You know, if we fund this project, well, of course, certainly you want to make sure you protect 100% of the active firefighting force. And a lot of people read that too quickly and say, you know, 100% of our people. Well, we've got, you know, 10 life members that really don't fight fire anymore, but, you know, we've got some that, you know, are EMS only, so they don't really count. But, you know, so some people put, well, only, you know, 3/4 of our people, members of the department, will be covered. But in reality, it is 100% of the firefighters will be covered. So in that case, you know, they're not going to fund incomplete solutions. So we want to make sure that, you know, you are going for a complete solution, and we mark the application as such, because little details like that can affect the scoring, you know, whether through the computer or whether through peer review. And in a game, you know, in a big setting like this with 22,000 departments, it does come down to, you know, fractions of a point sometimes. So it's good after we type everything in, you know, if we were doing it late and doing it quick, you know, at midnight, maybe, you know, our eyes are deceiving us, just to save it and have somebody check it the next day and make sure that everything was in right, and then press the submit button, make sure you get an application number back. It'll come back on the status screen, and we should be getting emails back from DHS automated that says, you know, thank you for applying, and they'll also send you your application number in that email as well. And at that point, it's time to kick back a little bit and relax, because it is a stressful time period for everybody. You know, this is we've all got our problems, and they're all important to everybody, and I'm sure we're stressing out a whole lot, and it's time to relax a little bit and, you know, wait, because we do have a few months. The applications do have to go through the computer, and then we've got to arrange peer review in the next couple months, and then after that, it'll go through the tallying, and this year they expect to be issuing awards anywhere from June all the way through December. So we do have a little bit of time, after that comes out. But after we relax, I mean, it's certainly a good idea. I recommend to a lot of people, you know, issue a press release. I mean, let's let the public know that, you know, hey, we realize, you know, we don't have enough money to get this done. You know, we understand, you know, nobody likes increases in taxes. But, you know, we're going after this grant program because we need this piece of equipment. And one department I work with, you know, told them, you know, let's go out and do this. And they issued a press release and said, you know, we need some other items, but, you know, they specifically keyed in on the thermal imager and the benefits of having a thermal imager and increased search speed and, you know, more likely to make rescues and have survivors from trapped victims. And some of the local people, you know, business people in the area said, well, you know, that's something we really need. I mean, they need that to protect us. And the residents started a fund drive on their own and ended up raising enough money to purchase that camera. And that's something they would have never known to do. And now here we have their problem solved. You know, they have their thermal imager. I mean, maybe the grant might not have come through. And, you know, they still wouldn't have had a thermal imager. But here it is, you know, they have it not long after submission and problem solved. And things like that happen. It's just, you know, opening the lines of communication with the public. You know, the fire service has this kind of mentality that, you know, we're the ones everybody calls for help. You know, we're not very good at asking for help. But you know, not very few people in this country have money laying around. I mean, there's certainly, you know, not that many Donald Trump fire departments that have unlimited funding. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, you know, we need some extra money. We don't want to raise your taxes. It's a good faith effort on our parts to keep the public, keep the communication lines with the public open.
All right, cool. And then it's, you know, it's time. They're making the notifications. You get a letter. It says that you've been denied. What do you do then? Do you get mad, or do you try and find out what happened? Do they tell you what happens that doesn't get you the grant, or?
Well, our gut reaction is to get mad. We all do when we get told no, especially after the amount of work that goes into these. They're getting a little more informative, of course, with the volume of applications, and, you know, there aren't that many people in the program office. So it is, you know, it is the same people dealing with previous grant awards and keeping up with that paperwork, in addition to handling this year's awards and getting everything out. So they're certainly overworked in their positions as well. So they can't really go in and tell us, you know, what was missing. They can tell us to what stage we got. Usually the first round of letters that comes out are the people who did not make it to peer review, usually in August time range, which, you know, at that point it says, you know, we did not, you know, your application wasn't deemed competitive enough to make it to the second level of review, which is peer review. So statistically, it's basically saying that, you know, what you were going for was not deemed to be very competitive based on your statistics. Little things, I mean, like going for an aerial with no tall buildings. That's one of the major metrics, of course, for determining that type of need. And things like that. So that'll happen in the first round because they only review 200% of the funding that's available. Coming into 2006, we're looking at about $125-130 million for vehicle awards. What they'll do in the computer ranks and scores is it'll just be one big long list. So we'll have, you know, application 1 all the way down through 7,000 ranked in order of score. And they'll go down the cumulative total. So as they go down, when they get to maybe award 2,000, you know, that adds up to 250 million. Award, you know, application, you know, 2001 on won't make it to peer review because, you know, statistics and probability that they won't have enough money by the time they score the rest of those applications to even make an award at that point. 200% is about the accepted statistical limit for handing out the money to those that meet the needs the most. So the top 200% of the funding will go into peer review. And then from there, of course, they'll score a narrative that we worked so hard on, and against what they were looking for. And then as awards start to come out, we'll get additional denials that will come out as well. First one that comes out after those that didn't make the computer, you know, will usually be those that either didn't have a very high computer score and their narrative wasn't very convincing either. They'll let them out first and just keep that going on until we either have all the awards and all the denials out. So the further along we make it before we get a denial, the more likely it is that we did meet the priorities, we stated a good case, and usually we say those that made it to the last round of denials, they just ran out of money. There just wasn't enough funding this year. If we had an extra 10 or 20 million, you know, we might have awarded this. And at that point, you know, we need to look and we need to analyze where do we get denied and what do we need to do from there. Usually computer denials, probably the wrong project for the problem we were trying to solve. In the case of vehicles, it may not necessarily be. There's just too many vehicle awards. They only read about 25 out of 100, so of course 75 out of 100 don't make it to that point. Doesn't necessarily mean they didn't, you know, do a proper assessment or anything. There's just too much competition and too little money for this. If we did make it into peer review, we want to look. You know, maybe we did ask for too many things, and that helped lower our score. Or maybe we didn't explain fully in our narrative. Maybe it created more questions than answers as people were reading it. And even all the way down to the last round of denials, when we say that, you know, okay, maybe they just ran out of money. Well, you still can't sit on your laurels and say, okay, well, that was a great application. I just need to submit the same one next year. Well, my point of view is if you didn't get money this year, then we didn't really do our complete job. So you need to go back to the drawing board and start all the way back at the beginning. You know, redo our assessment. You know, what changed in a year? You know, did we change our tactics, operations? You know, did we fix part of this problem ourselves? And then look at the project. You know, did we really ask for too much? And then go through that round and then look at the narrative and say, okay, were we missing something? Was not something not explained clearly? And that way, you know, we go full circle again, and now we're ready again. You know, coming into 2007, we've got our homework done, you know, and we're ready to go, and it makes it easier on the next application.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to throw in? I guess you've thrown in everything you know, but I guess just, you know, just be careful with what you're doing. And I guess the biggest thing I picked up from you is, you know, sometimes you have to kind of settle on something, even if you want to get one particular thing, sometimes you're going to have to settle just to solve the problem because they only care if you solve the problem, right?
Right.
Okay. All right, Brian, well, thank you very much. For the folks listening, this is part two of a four-part series on getting the green, trying to win the fire service grant money. Please check in the next couple of days. We're going to have another part, part three, that focuses on some of the folks who have actually won. You know, the money that they get is obviously supporting both their, or helping their department, helping their community, and that's what this whole program is designed for. So please join in within the next couple of days at radio@firehouse.com. Listen in, and, you know, best of luck to you folks trying to get the money out there. Brian, thank you very much. And again, I'd like to thank our sponsor for this program. The generous sponsorship from Plume Event is helping to get the word out to all the departments who are looking.
Plume Event is a driving force in advancing firefighter health and safety. Plume Event diesel exhaust removal system features 100% source capture to eliminate all diesel exhaust from the firehouse as stated in the NFPA 1500 standard. Plume Event exhaust removal systems meet the requirements stated in the Fire Act program guidance for modifications to facilities. Visit PlumeEvent.com or click on the link on this page to learn more about their exhaust removal systems. Again, thank you very much, and please tune in to radio@firehouse.com. Thank you.